Thank you, Bodell. I guess based upon this introduction, I ought to be about the happiest man in Cache Valley. I don't know that I'm particularly happy to be here at this moment, but I think that if I can share with you the things that I have in my heart, I would hope that at the end of this hour, I will still be happy. Out at our home, we've had a very interesting life the last several years, and that isn't the topic that I'm going to address myself to necessarily, but we're thinned down considerably until it's a joke around our place. We get down around 10 or 12 or 14 at the dinner table, and we say it's hardly worth setting the table anymore. Sometimes I wonder how I got into all of this. It wasn't very long ago, it seems to me, that I was just a young, happy-go-lucky person like most of you, looking ahead to marriage. And I'd always felt, I came from a family of 10, and it was rough. We were born and raised during the Depression, and I little knew what the Lord had in store for me, but it's been a great experience so far, and I told my wife that if we could endure the first 5 years, I thought we'd make it after that, and it's been 6 years, and so I think there's hope for us. You know, as I thought of this topic, I've been here many years and listened to the brethren and sisters intently as they've talked here to the subject religion and life. And it can be kind of a worn-out subject, I guess, if you looked at it the wrong direction. But since Brother Elmo Krogh approached me some time ago and asked me about being one of the speakers, I have thought about religion a lot and what it really means to me. It seems like I'm up to my ears in it, and yet we never get enough of it. The last many years I've been involved very closely in the church, and I thought at one time if I could just become a seminary teacher when I finally had arrived at that point, I thought I'd just have one foot in the celestial kingdom. And I think that I do, and I did, but I wasn't conscious of where the other foot was. And I sometimes have learned that it was probably on a banana peeling. That there's never a time when you haven't made. And I think I can testify and maybe express the feeling of these, my brethren here to my left, that just because we're institute teachers, men sometimes of years of experience in the gospel and in teaching, it doesn't mean that we have arrived. By any means. In fact, I believe I can truthfully say that the greatest trials of my life have come in recent years. And I don't think there's ever been a time when I have worked as hard at living the gospel as I do today. But as I look back over my life, I can see that the Lord has sustained me, and that he has blessed me as I have tried to keep his commandments. I've taught the course Comparative Christian Religions for some years here. And recently they've asked me to teach World Religions. I wasn't especially happy about that, but someone has to do it, and I thought maybe I'd try it again. But as I've analyzed religion, I think it's the most important facet of our lives. I really do. When you get right down to it, without religion, I think that my life would be rather meaningless. As I progressed along in my schooling, I started out in history, a major in history, and then I gravitated from there over into religion, and finally got a degree which they called the history of religion. And so I've moved kind of from history into religion. And if I have to choose between the two, give me religion. But I find, of course, that history is a subject I love and is very helpful to me. Now, as I have analyzed my life and what has brought me to this point where I have such a strong conviction, strong feelings about the Lord and about the church, I look back through my life, and some of the things I'm going to tell you today, I don't think I've ever told anybody else, at least all at one time. I have organized some thoughts, and with the Lord's help, I'd like to share some of the innermost feelings of my heart and share with you some of the experiences that I've had in life up to this point. As I indicated, that I was one of 10 children. I was born in the 20s, and I was reared during the Depression years. I looked at my home life and tried to analyze just how much impression it had upon me and what happened there that brought me to such a firm conviction that I have. And I often wondered what it was all about, and when I look back and look at religion. Because I remember as a young man, it never entered my head to go on a mission. The thought never crossed my mind. Now in those days, things were different. We weren't saying everyone should go on a mission and every member missionary, and things were different back in the 30s. But it never entered my head once. I had no intention. In fact, in those days, the war was on and coming on, and many of us thought it was a great thing if we finished high school. And many of my colleagues dropped out of high school and got married, went into service, and began to work. And for my love for athletics, I stayed in and finished high school. Never had any thought about going on to college. In fact, when I finally went back, began college, I'd been out 7 years. It took me a while to get warmed up again. But looking back into my home, my mother married my father, Art Wengreen, and he'd never been baptized. And I can't figure that out. I've been studying our family tree, and my grandfather and grandmother were Latter-day Saints, both reared in Sweden, and came over here. They married, and my dad was the only one out of the whole family who was never baptized. Anyway, my mother married him, and then after the first child came, he was baptized. But as far as I can learn, he was never a faithful member of the church. He was one of the, what we call the smoking elders, and he was just kind of half warm in the church. And these were hard times during those times. And in 1930, when I was just a boy, my father disappeared. And so mother reared the children alone. Just before my dad left, we had lived in California and had moved. The Depression had hit in about 1929, and 1930, we came back to Idaho. And I think that the only earthly possessions that we had that I remember was a great big wooden box that I remember seeing setting out in the road when it was let off the truck. And then shortly after that, my dad disappeared. And I think mother at that time had 8 children, is expecting the 9th, and one had died. And so we moved into a 3-bedroom home with my uncle and aunt, who had 6 children. And I've gone back and looked at that little house and wonder how we ever all got in. I do remember that for a while I had to sleep across the street in an old abandoned house. We had a bedroom rigged up there, and so we stayed in that at nights. You know, we were we were happy. We didn't even know we were poor, I guess. There were a lot of people who were poor during the Depression years. I think we were kind of at the bottom of the barrel. And I could tell you a lot of experiences about what it's like to be hungry and what it's like to not to have hardly any clothes. And I remember going to school barefooted when the weather would permit. And I remember one time that I got a 69-cent pair of gym shoes. And I about wore those out the first day, just running up and down the road. I was so happy. And I can remember a lot of other things that were typical of not just our family, but many. Around the table when you didn't know what butter was, really. They didn't have margarine. I remember in later years they got margarine, but it was just kind of white lard that you spread on your bread. And if you had company for dinner, you just went and cut another quart of water and poured it in the tomato soup. And anyway, these were hard years, but in many ways they were good years for me. Well, during these years, my mother was a faithful woman in the church in many ways. But I looked back and wondered why we never ever had family prayer. We just didn't. And as religious as my mother was, and the deep feelings that I have for her, and the deep impression that she's had upon me, yet in our home we never seemed to have much religion. And mother tried her best to move us along, but many of us became inactive. And out of the four children who married before I did, there was one of them married in the temple. One of them had married out of the church. And so it didn't look too good. But one thing I can remember, and that is that although during my teenage years I got away from the church, or it got away from me, I don't know just what happened. But I can remember night after night, even though I wasn't attending church meetings, I'd come home sometimes, it would be maybe wee hours in the morning, 1, 2, or 3 in the morning, and I can remember I'd kneel at my bedside and have prayer. And now where I got that, I don't know, but it stayed with me. And I think that's one of the things that helped pull me through. I look back over my life these last few weeks, and I can see times when I could see the hand of the Lord protecting me. When I was a boy, soon after my dad left, I was trying to get on a horse. I was standing on a fence trying to get on a big tall horse, and this as I got on it, I fell off. And fell off on the sidewalk, and rather mangled my left elbow. And I remember looking at it, and it was kind of a sorry looking sight with bones sticking out. And they put me into Model A Ford and Model T, whichever it was, and took me off Pocatello. And as the doctors looked over my arm, looked at it, they told Mother, it'll just have to come off. But I have to amputate. And Mother said, no, I won't consent to it. She said, you try to do what you can to patch it up. And if it doesn't work, you can always cut it off. That's the one. And I can remember laying for 9 weeks on my back with my arm up in a sling with weights on it. And my mother said that the doctors got their heads together and that five of them finally were there at the operating table and operated on it, put in a silver plate and spliced up the cord and a few other things. And then I remember I used to go into back to the doctor periodically, and he would have me hold out my arms and see if they were the same length. And I used to have to carry a bucket of sand around day after day. Well, I've got the arm, thanks to my mother, Now, I could have got through life without an arm. Many people are more handicapped than that. But because of my arm, I'd never been in the service. And it was in the service where I really came to know the Lord. I wouldn't have been able to be involved in athletics. That kept me in high school. And I can see many other blessings that have come to me. Well, I've still got the arm, and it's I should show you, it's a little crooked and a little small in the elbow, and I lay on it at night, can't get it going again and all, but I've often thought if the Lord should take it, he's welcome to it, all these years that I've enjoyed it. I thought of other things that had happened, where I think the Lord was with me. As a boy, I used to tend children all night for a quarter, which was pretty high pay in those days. Just for the evening, well, you'd get a nickel or a dime. But money was really scarce. And I remember as a boy, I used to drive the derrick horse a lot, you know, forward and backwards and forward and backwards. Some of you farmers don't know what that is. And I used to tromp hay. And in those days, they'd cut the hay and bunch it, and then you'd have to pitch it on the hay wagon. And so as a hay tromper, you'd just stay out of the road of the pitchfork, and then you'd try to tromp it so that you could get it stacked right on the rack. But the bed of the rack itself was about 3 or 4 feet high, and then they have the supports, and it goes on up. And I was up on the top of one of those loads, they're 12, maybe 10, 12, 14 feet high, tromping one day, and all of a sudden, I don't know what happened, but I went off of the top and lit on the ground in the hayfield on my neck. And I was unconscious, and in those days, there wasn't even a doctor at McCam in Idaho. You didn't go there unless you really hurt or was ready to die. So they finally brought me to, and I was walking around in a circle and dizzy and all, and was sick for some time after that, but got over it. At the age of 12, my mother was rearing these children alone, and we were right in the midst of the Depression, and my uncle came to see us, Uncle Walter from California. He'd married a Catholic woman. And they had their eye on me, and they proposed to my mother that they would take me back to California and raise me. And they bought me a new pair of corduroys and a new shirt, and I have a picture of that, incidentally, now. And I really thought I was great, you know. And I was not didn't object to it. And so they took me back to Vallejo, or to Oakland, California, and were going to keep me. They didn't have any children of their own. And I've often thought of what my life would have been like had I been reared by them. I have a letter on my desk at home from my Uncle Walter that was written to me earlier this year, about an 8 or 9 page later letter. And I wrote to him and I asked him for information about the family. But in that letter, he is chiding the Latter-day Saints, he's chiding me. After all of these years, he's still unconverted and picking at the church, telling me about the anti-Mormon books that he's been able to get a hold of and to read. And I've been saving that letter so I could write to him when I'm in the right spirit to see if I can't help him. But anyway, as I stayed with these people, I lasted 3 weeks. I was willing to stay, but I've never told a living soul this, I don't think, and if it's on the tape, I'm going to erase it, but the age of 12, I developed a bedwetting problem, and that was more than they could take, and that I've never done it before nor since, thank goodness. But that was the straw that broke the camel's back, and they took me down to the depot, put me on the train all by myself, and shipped me back to Idaho. And I've often thought about that and been thankful to the Lord that I came back to be reared with my family. At the age of 16, when I was a junior in high school, I left home one morning and I went and told my mother in the morning, I says, I'm headed to California. And I talked with her a little bit about it before, and so she gave me her blessing and said, okay, and I took off and hitchhiked to California from southern Idaho up here, and I got me a job at O.P. Skaggs, a drugstore. And the manager took a liking to me, and I was living at that time with another uncle and his wife and two or three cousins. And they wanted me to stay with O.P. Skaggs, and the manager said, we'll send you to school your last year and pay for it. If you work for us, work and go to school at night so that you can finish, we'd like to keep you in our company. Well, by that time, I was old enough to make some of my decisions for myself, and I said no, and I went back home again. Well, there are other things that have happened, I think, where I can see the hand of the Lord in my life. I've done some foolish things, and the Lord could have wiped me out easily if he didn't want to keep me. I was working, got out of high school, and I was working up at Pocatello, Idaho at the Naval Gun Plant. And they had some large pits about 50 feet across and about 80 to 100 feet deep. I won't explain the process they used to take the rifling out of the cannons as they dipped them in the oil later, but I was working as a rigger's helper. First of all, I was working down at the bottom of the pit and on the end of a jackhammer, leveling off the cement, and there were wooden steps going up nearly 100 feet that we'd go up and down. And we went up at noontime one day, and as we came back, I said, I think I'll go down the scaffold. And we had scaffolding along the side of the, on the inside of this pit. And we were taking out the metal cones that had been put into the cement. Now we could screw them out now that the cement was dry. And this was a scaffold that would go clear to the top. And the scaffold was about, I don't know, just near the top, but the ropes were hanging down. Anyway, I thought I'd go right over the top and I'd just grab a hold of those ropes. There were about 6 or 8 1-inch ropes. And I just wasn't thinking, and I was pretty young and tough at that time, and so I just went over the side, and I was going down hand over hand to the bottom, and all of a sudden it occurred to me that my hands were getting weak and I was losing my grip. I couldn't, it was too large. I couldn't get a hold of anything, and I couldn't get my legs around the rope. And so as I was going down, I was just going to get down as far as I could before I knew I'd have to drop, and I was really praying. And so I went on down, and I got down about 20 feet from the bottom. And the rope was, the end of the rope was, we had dangling down in a metal barrel, a 50-gallon barrel, that we'd cut the top of it off. And so that the end of the rope could dangle into that. And so as I came down, all that was straight below me was that barrel with the top cut out and cement otherwise. And I was really praying as quickly as I knew how as I went down, and I got down so far and I just let go. The first thing I knew, I had lit with feet up in that barrel. And had I lit just a few inches one way or the other, I could have been cut in two or badly hurt. But I lit in there unhurt. Well, let me tell you one more. I want to get up to the present here a little bit. I was out hunting with one of my pals when we were in high school, the 12-gauge shotgun, and we just had one gun between us. And as we passed through the fence, we got through the fence, and then I went on ahead of him a few feet. And all of a sudden, I just instinctively grabbed my ears and lifted my right foot. And that shotgun had gone off behind me. and I just felt the impact of it go by my right leg and plow a furrow in the ground just a few feet ahead of me. There again, just another few inches, it could have been very disastrous. So as I've looked back over those things, I have found that the Lord has blessed me and has preserved me with good health and strength to this point. You know, you would think that eventually you'd come to a point where you're safe. I know you've arrived. But I don't think it happens. I think a man can be born spiritually. I think that he can rise to great heights. But so does Satan. He rises right with you. And the man today who has the greatest opposition is the president of the church. In our family, as I said, we had the 10 children, 6 boys and 4 girls. Older boy was killed, accidentally shot in the head with a 22 as he and his friend were out hunting. When he was 15, he was the oldest boy, just getting old enough to really help. Out of the 5 boys that are in the family today, I'm the only one who went on a mission. And I have found, I'm the oldest living son now, and I have found when there have been times when I have had to try to be a savior to my own brothers and sisters. Now let me just illustrate a point or two. A few years ago, we decided we'd have a Wen Green reunion. Mother has, I don't know, I think 41 or 42 grandchildren now, and many great-grandchildren. And I, at that time, was not the oldest son, and I have 3 older sisters. And so they were planning to have this family reunion, and they were planning to have it on the Sabbath, as many families were doing some years back. But as it came to my attention, I said, no, I am not in favor of that. And one of my sisters said, well, that's the only time we can have it. We need that traveling time and all, and there were many good arguments. And finally I said, well, if you insist on having it on the Sabbath, I said, you go ahead. But I and my children will not be there. Well, that turned the tide. We had it on Saturday, and we've had it ever since. Something happened more recently, and I don't know if you agree with me on this one, but this is something that I wrestled through with my family. My mother turned 80 years of age on July the 15th. And so the family began to talk about having an open house for my mother near her 80th birthday. The first I heard about it, they were talking a little bit about the days and the dates that they would have it, and I just kind of put in my 2 bits worth, and I said, well, I hope that we don't have it on Sunday. And then later on, when the one particular son who was going to have it in his home told me that it was pretty well decided that it would be on the Sabbath. And anyway, I called him later and talked with him on the telephone long distance. It cost me quite a lot of money by the time we got through. But I tried to talk him out of it, and his wife got on the telephone. And my wife got on the other line in our home. We were having a 4-way conversation pretty soon. And it went on and on. We had quite a discussion about it. And then, so there again, I said, now, it might be just a small thing to many people. But I said, I've just recently taught a Sunday school lesson out in our ward to the young married couples on observing the Sabbath, and I know that President Kimball is not in favor of that. He's very strong on observing the Sabbath. And I used every device I could to try to persuade them, but finally to no avail. And so they set it up, set out the announcements that my mother's home, open home, would be on this particular Sabbath. Now, what would you do if you were in my place? I didn't want to go, and I decided I would not go, and I talked it over with my family and my wife. To make it easier for me, however, she was up in Idaho, so I had my sister bring her down to our home, and on Friday night, she stayed at our home. Then I took her on into Provo on Saturday, spent as much time as I could with her that Friday and that Saturday, but then Saturday night I went home. And I was the only one of the family who was not there. And I've had many of my relatives and brothers and sisters who thought that I was just a little bit too straight-laced, that I couldn't give a little bit. But that's the way I feel about the Sabbath, and that's the way I feel about following the prophet. There's no use of me teaching and claiming that I will follow him and sustain him if I'm not going to do the things that he asked me to do. Because it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's just as if the Lord himself has said it in every instance. And that's the way I feel about it. And that's what a prophet's for, is to speak for the Lord. Well, you may not agree with me on that one. But I didn't go to my own mother's open house. I talked with her about it, explained my feelings. I think she understands. Well, recently, about 4 years ago, my mother developed cancer. And she was taken into the University of Utah Medical Center. And was there thoroughly examined by specialists, and we went in and talked with the doctors and all, and they determined that she had cancer of the cervix and that it was past surgery. And so it was, we were trying to decide what to do, whether she should take treatments or whether just wait and let time take its course. And my mother said to my oldest sister, "Eva, if I just knew where my husband was, I believe I could die in peace." It had now been over 40 years since my father had disappeared, and we'd never heard one word. We'd followed certain leads and all, but we didn't know if he was alive or dead all those years. Mother had never remarried and had reared the children by herself. But she said, "Oh, I just knew where Art was, I could die in peace." And so my sister, who is a very pervasive place, a person, very intense, she went to work on that case and did something the FBI and others had not been able to do in all those years. To make a long story short, she found out that my dad had died in San Diego, California in 1957. Well, as I went to the hospital, or went to my mother's home to give her a blessing, after it was determined that she had terminal cancer, one of the other brothers anointed, and I confirmed the anointing. And I don't remember the exact words that were said, but the Spirit was there as we gave our mother a blessing. And she is alive today and in better health than she was then. Except the last few months, she's been able to, she's falling away a little bit because of another problem in her back. But as far as we know, there's no cancer. And we've enjoyed her another 4 years. Well, I was able to take my Father's name into the Logan Temple here a year or two ago and to be his proxy. And then earlier this year, my family, my mother and some of our children, our brothers and sisters, were able to go into the Logan Temple and to be sealed as a family after all those years. Well, I was going to say a little bit about my children, my family. Just to say that all seemed to be going well until a few years back in 1968, as I was sitting in the temple again, waiting for my wife to come over to join me for a temple session. And while I was sitting there waiting for her, she was taken in an instant in a car accident over Nibley. I was going to say this is the greatest shock of my life, but I don't think it was. Because of the gospel, my knowledge of how it operates in life and death, I was able to accept that. The initial shock was terrible, but I soon was reconciled to it. And I never think of my wife as laying up in Provo in the cemetery, because I know that isn't where she is. And on two occasions, I've been able to see her. I think the greatest shock of my life was when this widow moved in around the corner with her 8 children. I was her bishop. I told my wife someday she ought to write the story of I married my bishop. I think the biggest shock of my life is when I went on an institute social, and I saw that widow over there. I was without a partner, and that widow over there, I thought, well, she'd like to get out of the house, and so I invited her over there to go with us, little realizing what was going to happen. I remember I told Wes Christensen one time I went out with a widow with 8 children. He said, brother, you better do different than that. But I think the biggest shock of my life was I just had been with her a time or two, and it was revealed to me that I was to marry her. Not that I didn't want to marry her, but my wife, in an almost open vision, had the same manifestation. And so that's another story, that we just went ahead and got married. We didn't wait for a house that would fit us. We lived in 2 houses for a while, didn't we, Bodell? We've had a very exciting life these last few years. But as I look back through my life, I know that the hand of the Lord has been with me. And I know that He loves each of you as much as He loves me. He doesn't divest me of my problems and my weaknesses. I have to handle those myself. But He sees me through. And I think there's still hope for me. And I'm working on it. Well, my testimony evolves around some very sacred concepts to me, and I'll just give them to you and close and to this effect, that I love the scriptures and I try to spend a lot of time in them, because I know this is where you can get to know the Lord, that the mind and the will of the Lord is revealed to you in the scriptures, and the answer to your problems is there in the scriptures. I love to follow the brethren. I love to read them, listen to them, and to bear testimony of them every time I get an opportunity, that they are inspired men. And your salvation and mine depends upon following those brethren to the end. I desire to do that, and I have that conviction. Well, I think maybe our time is gone, but I'd like to leave you my testimony, brothers and sisters, and tell you that religion in life works.